Ages in Chaos by Emmanuel Velikovsky. Volume 1, From the Exodus to King Akhenaten. Abacus Edition, 1973. About the author. Emmanuel Velikovsky was born in Vitebsk, Russia in 1895, and has studied at the universities of Moscow, Berlin, Vienna, and Edinburgh. From 1921 to 1924, he edited, with Albert Einstein, the Scripta Universitatis Atque Bibliothecae Hieroso Limitarum, from which the Hebrew University was to grow. In 1939, he emigrated to America. His first book, Worlds in Collision, shook the scientific world when it was first published in 1950. His other books include Ages in Chaos, Earth in Upheaval, 1955, and Oedipus and Akhenaten. He now lives in Princeton, New Jersey, in the USA. From the Foreword. Ages in Chaos was conceived in the spring of 1940. It was then that I realized that the Exodus had occurred in the midst of a natural upheaval, and that this catastrophe might prove to be the connecting link between the Israelite and Egyptian histories, if ancient Egyptian texts were found to contain references to a similar event. I found such references, and before long had worked out a plan of reconstruction of ancient history from the Exodus to the conquest of the East by Alexander the Great. Already by October of the same year, I had come to understand the nature and extent of that catastrophe. For a decade after that, I worked simultaneously on Ages in Chaos and Worlds in Collision, the present work requiring the lion's share of the toil. Ages in Chaos covers largely the period dealt with in Worlds in Collision, the 800 years from the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt to the invasion of Palestine by Sennacherib in 687 before the present era, and the additional 3.5 centuries to Alexander of Macedonia, altogether 1,200 years of the history of the ancient East. But whereas the first work concentrated on the description of the physical history of the period, the present work deals with its political and cultural aspects. The occurrence of a widespread natural catastrophe serves here only as the point of departure for constructing a revised chronology of the times and lands under consideration. I searched the records of one land after another and went from one generation to another, taking from everywhere hints and clues, evidence and proof. Because I had to discover and to collate them, this book is written like a detective story. It is well known that in a detective work, unexpected associations are often built on minute details. A fingerprint on a bar of metal, a hair on a windowsill, a burnt-out match in the bushes. Some details of an archaeological, chronological, or paleographic nature may seem minor matters, but they are the fingerprints of an investigation in which the history of many nations and many generations is vitally involved. Such details are not included to make the reading difficult. They are necessary to establish the main thesis of this work. Therefore, any attempt to read this book cursorily will prove to be a fruitless undertaking. Correct strategy requires that once a bridgehead is established, it should be fortified. Is it good judgment instead to open a second front against a new adversary? After the publication of Worlds in Collision, a volume describing two acts of a celestial and terrestrial drama, reconstructed from the collective memory of the human race, a wise and proper move would have been to strengthen my position by following with a volume of geological and paleontological evidence of the same dramatic events in the life of the Earth. And since this material, from the realm of stones and bones, is not rare but abundant, such an undertaking would seemingly not be difficult. It was therefore a great temptation for me to continue from where I had left off in Worlds in Collision, to prove again and again, from new angles, that catastrophes did take place and did disrupt slow-moving evolution in inanimate as well as animate nature. And in fact, since the publication of Worlds in Collision, I have devoted myself to organizing the evidence from geology and prehistory to supplement the literary and historical evidence of cosmic catastrophism, and to writing Earth in Upheaval, only little concerned with the storm aroused by my first book. But I found that the arguments presented in that book were not given a careful hearing, or even reading, particularly by those who protested the loudest. Would it help to produce in haste still more evidence? In my inner counsel and strategy, I decided to tarry no longer with Ages and Chaos, my opus magnum. I call Ages and Chaos the Second Front because, after having disrupted the complacent peace of mind of a powerful group of astronomers and other textbook writers, I offer here a major battle to the historians. The two volumes of the present work will be as disturbing to the historians as World in Collision was to the astronomers. It is quite conceivable that historians will have even greater psychological difficulties in revising their views and in accepting the sequence of ancient history as established in Ages and Chaos than the astronomers had in accepting the story of cosmic catastrophes in the solar system in historical times. Indeed, a distinguished scholar who has followed this work from the completion of the first draft in 1942 expressed this very idea. He said that he knows of no valid argument against the reconstruction of history presented here, but that psychologically it is almost impossible to change views acquired in the course of decades of reading, writing, and teaching. The attempt to reconstruct radically the history of the ancient world, 1,200 years in the life of many nations and kingdoms, unprecedented as it is, will meet severe censure from those who, in their teaching and writing, have already deeply committed themselves to the old concept of history. And many of those who look to acknowledged authorities for guidance will express their disbelief that a truth could have remained undiscovered so long, from which they will deduce that it cannot be a truth. Should I have heeded the abuse with which a group of scientists condemned Worlds in Collision and its author? Unable to prove the book or any part of it wrong or any quoted documents spurious, the members of that group indulged in outbursts of unscientific fury. They suppressed the book in the hands of its first publisher by the threat of a boycott of all the company's textbooks, despite the fact that when the book was already on the presses, the publisher agreed to submit it to the censorship of three prominent scientists, and it passed that censorship. When a new publisher took the book over, the group tried to suppress it there, too, by threats. They forced the dismissal of a scientist and an editor who openly took an objective stand, and thus drove many members of academic faculties into clandestine reading of Worlds in Collision and correspondence with its author. The guardians of dogma were, and still are, alert to stamp out the new teaching by exorcism and not by argument, degrading the learned guild in the eyes of the broad public, which does not believe that censorship and suppression are necessary to defend the truth. And here is a rule by which to know whether or not a book is spurious. Never in the history of science has a spurious book aroused a storm of anger among members of scientific bodies. But there has been a storm every time a leaf in the Book of Knowledge has been turned over. Quote, "We are most likely to get angry and excited in our opposition to some idea when we ourselves are not quite certain of our own position and are inwardly tempted to take the other side." End quote. A scientific approach requires, first, reading, then thinking and investigation, and lastly, the expression of an opinion. In the case of Worlds in Collision, the procedure was repeatedly reversed. Scientific rejection demands invalidation of the evidence presented. Nothing of the kind was done with Worlds in Collision. The few arguments offered, whatever could be gathered from numerous reviews, I answered point by point in a debate with Professor J.Q. Stewart, astronomer at Princeton University, published in the June 1951 issue of Harper's Magazine, 14 months after the publication of the book. No argument was left unanswered, and no new one has been presented since then, though emotional outbursts have not ceased. Finally, a new strategy was employed. The views expounded in Worlds in Collision were appropriated piecemeal by those who first opposed them, though not with frankness and candor, but rather under the guise of showing how wrong the author of that heretical book is. At present, no chapter of Worlds in Collision needs to be rewritten, and no thesis revoked. Great are the changes in the political history of the ancient East offered in Ages and Chaos. I claim the right to fallibility in details, and I eagerly welcome constructive criticism. However, before proclaiming that the entire structure must collapse because an argument can be made against this or that point, the critic should carefully weigh his argument against the whole scheme, complete with all its evidence. The historian who permits his attention to be monopolized by an argument directed against some detail to the extent of overlooking the work as a whole and the manifold proofs on which it stands will only demonstrate the narrowness of his approach to history. He will be like that conscientious scientist, Professor Twist, in Ogden Nash's verse, who went on an expedition to the jungles, taking his bride with him. When, one day, the guide brought the tidings to him that an alligator had eaten her, the professor could not smile. "You mean," he said, "a crocodile?" I believe that the evidence collated in Ages and Chaos warrants the reconstructed offer. Sooner or later, and it may be any day, some new archaeological discovery will verify the main thesis of this book, and then it will become apparent even to the indolent, for whom only a fulfilled prophecy is an argument. The recent discovery of two language texts, Old Hebrew and Hittite pictographs, and thus of a clue to the undeciphered pictographs of Asia Minor and Syria, give promise of revealing facts of unmeasured significance. For this reason, too, I should delay no longer the present publication. Is it not the case that at first a new idea is regarded as not true, and later, when accepted, as not being new? Emanuel Velikovsky, February 1952.